Today on the 21st show, it's Juneteenth National Independence Day, when we commemorate the emancipation of enslaved African Americans. Today, we'll be looking back at the legacy of slavery in Illinois. It began with French settlers in the 1600s, and while Illinois entered the Union as a free state, it took another three decades to fully eradicate all forms of enslavement here. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, national and international news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And today is Juneteenth, the national holiday commemorating the emancipation of enslaved African Americans. When Illinois became the 21st state admitted to the Union, it was as a free state, as opposed to a state that permitted slavery. But that was just one chapter in the long history of slavery and its legacy in Illinois, dating all the way back to the 1600s, when French settlers brought enslaved people with them as they came to the area. That practice continued under English rule into Illinois' days as a territory. As we've talked about before on the program, there was intense debate over slavery at the time of Illinois' statehood. A few years later, in fact, just in 1823, two centuries ago this year, pro-slavery legislators tried to call a new state constitutional convention so that they could explicitly allow slavery in Illinois. Then, as now, the question went to voters, who defeated the proposal. But that was only after a year of intense debate over slavery, for and against. Two centuries later, the effect of those votes, and the debate surrounding them, and the region's long history of slavery and other racist policies, all that echoes through the years and still resonates today. So, for our entire program, we're going to try to understand some of that history. We originally had this conversation back in March. Because of that, we're not taking calls live today, but we do appreciate hearing what you thought about our show, so send us an email. The address is talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Okay, here now is our conversation on Illinois and slavery. Joining us now is Caroline Kissel. She's an associate professor in the School of Continuing and Professional Studies at DePaul University in Chicago. She's also an Illinois Humanities Rhodes Scholar. Caroline, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
Also with us for this conversation is Kiffany Duggar. She's a graduate student in history at Jackson State University in Mississippi, and she's working on a documentary about Nance Leggins Cosley, the first enslaved person legally freed by Abraham Lincoln back when he was a traveling lawyer. Kiffany, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
And later in the program, we're going to be joined by a sociology professor to talk about the legacy of this history and how we still see its effects today. So, Caroline Kissel, I want to start with you. And in the years, the centuries, even before Illinois became the 21st state, we asked listeners in our texting club what they wanted to know about this history. And Greg in Champaign asked us, it said, how many centuries before statehood was there slavery, and who were the enslaved people, and who were the slave owners? So can you talk about the years before Illinois was even a state?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking the question. I believe that was Greg in Champaign. I appreciate that. So really, we're looking back to the early 1700s. And there are the French archives tell us that Jesuits owned around 16 to 18 enslaved people in 1720. But there is a possibility, too, that there were enslaved people who were owned in the territory that was under French rule earlier than that, in the late 1680s, to work in the wheat field. So this was at the time when Illinois was under French rule, was part of French Louisiana, before the Louisiana Purchase, and enslaved people were brought in to cultivate the land in support of the French settlers who were settling there.
What was the attitude around slavery at that time? Was this something that was debated then, or was it more just accepted as the so-called natural order?
Well, you know, that's a really great question. And I don't know if I have the full answer on that. But what I can say is that my understanding from my research is that it was accepted. So under the French crown, this was an accepted practice. So it wasn't like we would have, there's a lot of debates, for example, going on around the country, and even specifically at my university, around what were the practices of religious communities who had enslaved people in this early period of time? What were they doing? But those kinds of debates were not in effect at the time. What I think you do see are people who, some who had a moral conscience, who were not doing the practice as much. There's some reporting around those French codes. So there was the French Code Noir, or Black Code, that regulated the behavior and the lives of enslaved people during this time. And there's some reporting that says the codes recognized slaves as human beings, because enslavers had to provide food, shelter, clothing, and they had to give them Sundays and holidays off. They had to instruct them in the Catholic faith. So there was that blanket of, we're doing this under, the Catholic faith. But the codes, it's important to also note that the codes also described Black enslaved people as chattels that could be bought and sold like other personal property.
Hmm. So let's move forward through time then. Mm-hmm. So centuries go by, the United States comes into being. There's the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, mm-hmm. which creates the Northwest Territory. Illinois is part of that. What did the Northwest Ordinance say about slavery?
Right. So the Northwest Ordinance was a federal law that mandated that any states that formed out of the territory north of the Ohio River, so today the states that we recognize would be Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin. I believe I've covered them all. It mandated that any states that formed out of this territory needed to deem that they were free states. So at this time, prior to 1865, when slavery was abolished at the federal level by the 13th Amendment, any states that came into being had to create a constitution that they declared that they were free states in this territory north of the Ohio River. So Illinois knew that it had to abide by the Northwest Ordinance, and yet they had all of this old slavery that existed previously. And the Constitution writers basically put into the Constitution the language of the Northwest Ordinance, which was, there shall be neither slavery nor involuntary servitude in the said territory, otherwise than the punishment of crimes whereof the party shall have been duly convicted. And that's the first line of the language. And that was typically codified in those state constitutions that deemed themselves as free states. But what Illinois did was they indicated that there shall be neither slavery nor involuntary servitude hereafter in the said territory. So that word hereafter is key, because hereafter basically was a recognition that there was old slavery in the territory that was allowed to continue on.
Yeah, old slavery and new slavery. And I want to come back to that idea, because mm-hmm. then, as now, there are different interpretations of federal law. But I want to bring mm-hmm. Kiffany Duggar into our conversation again, student in history at Jackson State University in Mississippi. And Kiffany, it's during this time, before, when Illinois is a territory, it's not yet a state, 1813, Nance Leggins Cosley is born in Kaskaskia, which is the capital at the time. She is born in to slavery, even though she was born in Illinois. How does that happen?
Yes, Nance was born in 1813 to Randall and Anache Liggins in the home of Thomas Cox, who was a land surveyor at the time. Mr. Cox would eventually go on to be a state senator. And because her parents, Randall and Anache, were indentured servants at the time, Nance was born into indentured servitude. So that is how she actually became a domestic servant. She was not considered a slave. She was considered an indentured servant.
Can you talk about what is the difference, both legally and then in effect, for the person who's actually living that experience?
Well, for the person who's actually living that experience, in some cases, there is no difference. It's free labor. Under indentured servitude is under a contract. Most servants, you would serve you could actually serve for a lifetime, actually. You are under contract to serve with a particular person, or you could be sold to other masters or contract holders. So the main difference legally in indentured servitude and slavery is that the state of Illinois at the time that Nance was born had abolished slavery. And so that clause in the they call it a loophole, of course, in the Northwest Ordinance that allowed for indentured servitude. So it's just a little small legal loophole that still allowed the simulation of slavery through indentured servitude.
And Caroline Kissel from DePaul University, is this what you were talking about when you were talking about old slavery and new slavery? And maybe you can just say more about that, particularly
sure.
in the context
yeah.
of yeah, Illinois statehood. Yeah,
right. And I think Nance is a really interesting example in this regard because she was born in 1813 prior to Illinois becoming a state. And Illinois was at the time the Illinois Territory. From 1809 to 1818, which would have been the time when she was born, was covered under other laws that carried forward some of these, the Code Noir from the 1700s, which carried forward. So, for example, there was an 1813 Illinois Act that basically allowed for it governed the behavior of enslaved people and indentured servants. One of the things I'll say about indentured servitude, just to add on to what Kiffany said, is that for that person living in the contract, there may have been no difference. But at the same time, that whole idea of we have a contract and supposedly the two parties have entered willingly into the contract, it's important to remember that African Americans in this time often were not literate. So they may have been signing a contract and even not knowing the length of time that was involved in the contract.
Tiffany, so let's come back to this story of Nance Liggins Cosley, because at age 13, she is sold, or her contract is sold, however you want to say that. And that was when her fight for freedom started. So can you remind us, what did that look like? What was that about?
Yes, well, in 1813, Nance was sold to Thomas Cox, the master or the contract holder. He was not a very responsible person in terms of money, and he ended up owing multiple creditors. And so there was a lawsuit filed against his estate, and Nance was considered at the time property. And one of the major questions in this case is, was she really considered property and could she be sold? And so she was sold to Nathaniel Cromwell. And during a period of a year, the during the period of the year, there was a court case, the Cromwell versus Cox, where there was an issue with her actually being sold. And so this court case went on for a year to just kind of determine whether or not she could actually be sold to Mr. Cromwell. And so it ended up in favor of Mr. Cromwell that Nance was actually property and she could be sold. Nance refused to go with Mr. Cromwell. And so that's how this court case ended up being a year and a half long battle for her freedom. But ultimately, she lost the case, stating that she was property and she could be sold with the estate of Thomas Cockwell, Thomas Cox, for the purpose of settling his debt.
Okay, so she had been born in 1813. She is this court case goes on when she's age 13, a teenager, I guess. And I should say, we need to take a break very soon in less than a minute here. But when does Abraham Lincoln enter into this story?
Abraham Lincoln enters in 1841. There had been a long battle. Now David enters David Bailey and Nathaniel, the estate of Nathaniel Cromwell after Nathaniel Cromwell passed. And so that was also a court case that lasted for a period of 2 to 3 years. And on the end of that case enters Abraham Lincoln, who was a friend of David Bailey. And I would love to discuss more about that after break.
And indeed, we're going to pause right there. We'll return and continue this conversation we had on the show back in March for the rest of our program today. It's Juneteenth, and we're talking about the history and legacy of slavery in Illinois. It entered the Union as a free state, but it was present in the area for centuries beforehand. And 200 years ago this year, some state legislators even tried to call a new constitutional convention so they could explicitly allow slavery here. We'll talk more about that after a short break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and today is Juneteenth, National Independence Day. Because of that, we are off and revisiting a conversation we had in the program back in March about the history and legacy of slavery in Illinois. From the first European settlers from France, through English rule, through our territorial history, and into statehood. We talked about this with Caroline Kissel, an associate professor at DePaul University, and Kiffany Duggar, a graduate student in history at Jackson State University in Mississippi. And a little later, we were joined by a sociology professor to talk about the legacy of this history and how that still carries through today. As I mentioned, our program is on tape, so we're not taking calls live, but we do appreciate hearing what you thought about this or any other segment we've done on the program. One way you can do that is by leaving us a voicemail. The number for that is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. And what we hear from you does inform our coverage. All right, let's pick up our conversation on slavery in Illinois, where we left off. So, Kiffany, before the break, we were talking about Nance Liggins Cosley. I don't know if you want to say more about Lincoln's involvement or just why her story is important and maybe how she's overlooked today.
Yes, her story is important. Of course, we're entering the fate of African American history is uncertain at this time. I would say there are so many laws on the books trying to ban the history of African Americans. And Nance Liggins Cosley is such an important part of history because she was technically the first African American, if you will, freed by, at the time, attorney Abraham Lincoln, who would go on to become the 16th president of the United States. And when we look at that connection and his fight for the abolition of his fight for emancipation, Nancy Liggins Cosley plays a key role in this because it is her case that actually influenced him to go further. once he became president, his interaction with this case, his experience with this case, Nance was such a pivotal part of him influencing him to have an emancipation as his platform as a president of the United States. And just her case and the fact that he won this case for her freedom when she had been in court for such a long period of time, for a period of 10 years of her life, she had been back and forth in court trying to gain her freedom. And along comes Abraham Lincoln, a young attorney at the time, and he wins this court case for her based on a clause in the Northwest Ordinance that says neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist in the state of Illinois. And so when we look at that and him proving that she was actually not a slave at the time, when she had been to court so many times and she was kept in bondage. And at the time, a young African-American woman pursuing her freedom was kind of to the level that she did on several occasions, was kind of unheard of at the time. And so she was a pioneer for her freedom. Not only that, but her legacy of freedom created a legacy for her son, William Henry, who was actually a United States colored troop soldier. And he was present in Galveston, Texas, for what we now know as Juneteenth. He was one of the soldiers that was responsible for informing enslaved people on the island of Galveston that did not actually know they were free, that they were actually free. And so she has a long legacy that should be explored. She is basically unknown and forgotten. And actually, her gravesite is actually paved over now in Tazewell County in Pekin, Illinois, where she spent many years and where she is now laid to rest. And so her legacy is very important. There are plans around Juneteenth to dedicate a marker to Nance. And so just wanting to help make people aware of her story and the contribution that she made toward other indentured servants in the state of Illinois.
So Carolyn Kissel, we've been very zoomed in on the story of Nance Liggins Cosley. Let's mm-hmm. zoom back out. How does her story illustrate the broader issue at the time in Illinois?
Yeah, Kafini, it was great to listen to your in-depth overview, because one of the things that's really a key piece to understand about Illinois became a state in 1818. It did incorporate that Northwest Ordinance clause, there shall be neither slavery nor involuntary servitude. But just recalling back the hereafter word that was added to the Constitution by the Constitution writers. And that also applied to indentured servitude contracts. So Nance's contract was prior to 1818. And there are other examples of enslavers coming into the state and registering indentured servants before Illinois became a state. So a prominent example of that is actually our territorial governor, Ninian Edwards, who is also Illinois' third governor in 1826. He was an enslaver from Kentucky. And he brought his 11 enslaved people into Illinois between April of 1810 and November of 1815. And again, that's prior to Illinois becoming a state. And he registered them as indentured servants. And this is all documented. It can be found in the Illinois State Archives, has a great servitude and emancipation records database. And you can look up by name or by county. And so he had a different levels of indentures going on even while Illinois crossed over into from being a territory and becoming a state. So that's one example. And then there are other examples of people who may have had, who saw that there's this indentured servitude law on the books in Illinois. And in fact, while Ninian Edwards was the territorial governor from 1809 to 1818, he vetoed legislation that came across his desk to change that law. So he kept that law intact.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We are talking about the history of slavery in Illinois from the days of the first French settlers here through after statehood, even though Illinois was ostensibly admitted to the Union as a free state. We're speaking about this with Caroline Kissel, associate professor at DePaul University, and Kiffany Duggar, who's a graduate student at Jackson State University in Mississippi. I do want to share a few text messages. Christopher in Brimfield said, "The history of slavery in the United States has been whitewashed for a long time, and it's continuing to be whitewashed even more today. I did not learn any of this when I was in school. We need to teach all of the history of America to school children, good and bad." And then somebody else from Pecatonica, Illinois, wrote in to say, "Relatively speaking, it would be better to go in depth with the genocide and slavery in our country and world when students are older in high school. Additionally, it's not that the kids are the problem, it's the adults. They are the ones having trouble understanding how mindsets of domination are embedded in our reality." Kiffany, you talked about this earlier. Illinois is not one of those states that is trying to, what would you say, suppress this history, but that is happening elsewhere. Can you just talk about what those listeners said, respond to what they said?
Yes, I agree. It's not the kids that's the problem, because I believe that kids are eager to learn. They want to know more. It's the adults, the administration, the lawmakers that feel like this history is embarrassing, that this history will cause a form of regret or embarrassment or make people feel bad. But it's history. You can deny history, but you cannot change history. And stories like Nance Liggins Cosley and other African Americans who have shaped and molded this country are important, because you need to know history, not just whitewash history, as one of the participants said, but the whole truth and nothing but the truth. Because if you don't understand history, then you're doomed to repeat it. And I just really see no harm in real history, in conveying the real history of what has happened. There is no embarrassment. I am, I've done my genealogy, and I am proud to be descendants of slaves. I have seen where we've been and how far we've gone and where we're going. And I'm proud of that history. And there are so many other African Americans that are proud of that history as well, but they don't understand their history and they don't know their history because it's being suppressed.
Well, Kiffany, we're going to let you go from the program at this point. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us and share your work today with us on the 21st show.
Thank you so much for having me and all my nervous energy. This was great. Thank you.
No, it was great. Thank you. Kiffany Duggar is a graduate student in history at Jackson State University in Mississippi. We're going to continue on now with Caroline Kissel, associate professor at DePaul University. So, Caroline, I want to kind of move a little bit more quickly through some of the remaining history from this era. So, Illinois enters the Union is the 21st state as a free state, but there is this indentured servitude. Pretty soon, just a few years in, 1823, there's this effort to plainly legalize slavery. Can you talk about that? Were there other states pursuing this kind of thing? What was that like?
Yeah. You know, if it's okay, I'd like to offer a counterexample to Ninian Edwards, because Edward Coles, who was our second governor, he plays into the response to this question about what happened in 1823. So Edward Coles was elected to his role as governor. Our first governor was Shadrach Bond, who also was an enslaver. So Edward Coles, though, is a really interesting case in that he was an enslaver by inheritance from Virginia. He was from a plantation family in Virginia. He inherited, and I see differing reports around this, anywhere between 17 to 23 enslaved people. And he his moral conscience was really triggered by a professor that he had, where he basically grew into not believing that slavery was immoral. And he actually wrote in a letter to an English immigrant in Illinois, George Flower, he wrote in 1823, "I was born in the very bosom of Negro slavery. I have seen it in all its bearings, rejected well upon the nature of it, and having found it impossible to reconcile it either with my political or religious creed, I abandoned my native state." So what he ended up doing was he moved to Illinois. He brought his enslaved people with him along the route. And as the story goes, he reached the north side of the Ohio River, and he gathered them together one morning for an announcement. And he announced that he was freeing them. And he ended up freeing his quote unquote property. And he gave each head of household 160 acres of land in Madison County, Illinois, to start their lives anew in the kind of complex state of Illinois at the time, because there were these laws on the books that were challenging, but they were free. They were legally freed by him. And the important thing about Edward Coles is he was elected by a narrow margin to the governorship in 1822. His lieutenant governor was pro-slavery. So it's a question mark where he had a certain amount of votes, but had they gone another way, he could have easily lost to being the governor. And while he was governor, and the reason I wanted to bring the story in about his freed enslaved people is that the Illinois Black Codes then were on the books from 1819. The Illinois Black Codes were based on earlier versions. There was the territorial Black Codes that were based on the Code Noir, which I mentioned earlier, from French Louisiana. And the Illinois Black Codes basically perpetuated those regulations of free Blacks, enslaved people, and indentured servants, and restricting movement, people having to pay to a guarantee of good behavior if they were to reside in the state as a free person. He was basically Coles being anti-slavery in his inaugural speech in 1822 could arguably be considered the inciter of this force that wanted to bring forth this convention to change the Illinois Constitution in 1823. So in 1820,
if you will. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. Exactly. And you know what? We need to pause here because we need to take another break. We'll continue this when we come back on this Juneteenth. We're listening back to our conversation from March on slavery's history and legacy in Illinois. And as we head into the final part, we'll be joined by a sociologist to talk about how some of those effects are still felt today. That's coming up after a short break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us.
Thank you.
It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and it's Juneteenth today, and we've been listening back to a conversation we originally first broadcast back in March about slavery and its history and legacy in Illinois. From our days as a French territory, through being an English territory, through our early time in the United States, and then after we became the 21st state, as we've been learning, slavery was not allowed, but indentured servitude was. And for the people who experienced it, it was basically slavery by another name and another legal means. We talked about this with Caroline Kissel, associate professor at DePaul University. Here now is the final part of our conversation as we add another voice to it. We are joined now by Brian Miller, who is going to help us discuss the legacy of slavery and other racist policies and how they are still felt today. He's a professor of sociology at Wheaton College in DuPage County near Chicago. Brian and Caroline have co-authored an article on the legacies of some of the racist policies here. It's called Property and Racial Exclusion in Illinois: Patterns and Practices from Colonial Slavery to Suburban Marginalization, 1720s to 2010s. That article is slated to run in a future edition of the Journal of the Illinois State Historical Society. Brian Miller, thank you for making the time to be with us today.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you to Caroline and Kiffany for sharing so much already.
So, Caroline, let's just quickly talk about then this 1823-1824 vote. I mean, there's so much to get into, and we only unfortunately have about 10 minutes left, but you know, the question ultimately goes to voters. The franchise is limited at this time. Maybe that's worth talking about. What was the shape of the debate at that time?
So I'll try to bullet point it here. So Coles, anti-slavery governor, he wanted to abolish the Illinois Black Codes completely. That caused a lot of reaction. And there was a clause in the 1818 Illinois Constitution that actually allowed for a lot of slavery on the ground, but it also specifically outlined that slavery, Kentucky farmers were allowed to bring their enslaved people into work in the salt mines in Gallatin County. It was actually written into the Constitution, and it was about to sunset in 1825. So those several different factors really kind of fomented the pro-slavery legislators at the time in the Illinois legislature, which was around 83%. And remember that Illinois was more densely populated in the southern region, in the 34 counties of the southern region of Illinois at this time. And Chicago was really not the heavy hitter that it is today. They brought forward in February 1823 this vote to call for a convention to change the Illinois state constitution to permanently allow slavery. I don't know how they would actually get that done, but I think that they were, you know, figuring that out and wanted the Illinois voters to vote on it. And so that passed on February 10th of 1823. And then for 18 months up until August 2nd of 1824, there was this very hostile climate in Illinois of a lot of anti-slavery writings in newspapers and pro-slavery responses and violence on the ground. And in fact, after the vote, the call for a convention passed, the legislators were parading in the streets at Vandalia, which was the state capital at the time, with torches. They actually burned an effigy of one of the legislators who had changed his vote to be anti-convention. That was Nicholas Hansen. So that gives you an idea of the climate at the time.
And so I'm going to zip through the next. So ultimately, that is defeated by the voters.
It's ultimately defeated by the voters.
It's defeated. Right. But it's not until the 1848 Illinois Constitution when the when slavery or indentured servitude is finally outlawed here. But those black codes persist. They actually get harsher over time. And Brian Miller, maybe I can bring you into the conversation now. Can you talk about that period of history and, you know, how we're still seeing that today, or it carries through time, right? Sundown towns is one such example.
I think what Caroline and I were really interested in doing in this paper was connecting this three centuries of history, 200 years since the Constitutional Convention, and roughly 300 years since the Jesuits enslaved people in Illinois, and thinking about those consequences. So after the Civil War, there's Reconstruction, but then there's retrenchment. There are sundown towns. There are three major race massacres in Illinois and Springfield and St. Louis and Chicago. There's redlining that develops in the 1930s. And then even after a lot of these things are officially made illegal in the 1950s and 60s through the courts and the legislature at the federal and state level, there are more informal practices where people are excluded from communities through zoning, decisions about development, and also made not to feel welcome, even though, you know, technically all people can move anywhere legally.
Yeah, and white flight, I would imagine, is another example of that, where people leave communities where African-Americans started to move in. Let's go to the phones. Line four, Tana is calling in from Menard County. Tana, thank you for calling in.
Hi, thank you. I've got to say something since you did bring up the things that are still racist-oriented. I became friends with a couple of people and helped them with a mission overseas, and she would, we talk openly about these issues, and one thing that she sent me something one time was about how white privilege we don't have to worry about being followed around a store to see if we're shoplifting. But anyway, I grew up in Macomb, which I'm pretty sure was a sundown town. There was one fella out of 137 high school classmates in my class that was not white. And there was, and we really kind of didn't realize when the Nigerians started coming to town to go to school at Western to get business degrees quite often, we really noticed them, you know. And I luckily grew up with, in my parents not teaching me to be racist. And
that did you learn about this sort of history, though? Sorry to interrupt
you. Again?
Did you learn about this history that we've been talking about today?
I have learned most of what I know about the history of people of color in this country from NPR in the last few years, in addition to my friend and to the and there was a and so no, the answer is no. And I was in school, started school in 1951, graduated in 64, whatever that comes out to. So anyway, obviously not good math. So but it's really significant what you're doing. And I know that a lot of people who I wish would don't listen, but I really have to appreciate the education I've gotten. And I was never taught to be close-minded, which really, really helped. And
sure.
So
all right. Well, Tana, thank you so much for calling in. We really appreciate it. Caroline, I don't know if you want to respond to anything she had to say there. This is more on the idea that we're kids are not necessarily learning this at school. Certainly not of that generation.
Yeah. So I teach a course at DePaul University that's about my research. We're shout out to my students. We're starting a new quarter tomorrow. One of the things that has struck me that I think connect to what Tana just shared is that I have typically a multi-generational class. So I have adult learners, I have more traditional age learners. And when polling the students, I often hear that the older students have not learned this history, but some of the younger students have been more aware of it. So that's encouraging to me that in high school, that maybe there's more coming into the classroom than has been in the past. And certainly was my experience growing up and going through the Illinois school system of not, you know, learning basically the black and white, so to speak. There were slave states and there were free states, and free states are, you know, didn't have any slavery at all. So
Let me share a text we got from Brandy in Urbana, who said, I learned that Illinois had slavery at one time, that it was pretty uncommon, and that by the time we joined the Union, there was no slavery in Illinois. Brandy goes on to say, I think there's a tendency to negate any need for reparations or other forms of leveling the playing field for minority people in Illinois because our history of slavery in our state is muddled, and we basically recuse Illinois of that wrongdoing. Brian, can you respond to that and maybe talk about some of the attempts at reckoning we're seeing today?
Yeah, as Caroline and Kiffany shared earlier, that the situation with slavery and indentured servitude was longer than most people realize and is often taught. And again, in this paper, what we're trying to argue is this has consequences for today. So who has access to property? Who was able to own a home? Who could own land? The sociologists have studied now, at least for several decades, we know that wealth inequality is largely driven by access to home ownership. And so how do you help different people groups buy a home and then have homes that are worth something in the long run? Communities seeking out reparations like Evanston, still a pretty unusual case where they've offered money to local residents who have suffered under the system for decades so they can use it for housing, to repair housing. But my sense is there's a lot more conversation and openness about this in many communities. I'd encourage people to get involved at the local community level, where there's often conversations taking place among residents and local leaders looking for ways to grapple with this history and try to make it right and acknowledge it, lament it, recognize it, and then also build a brighter future where everyone can be welcomed and involved.
Yeah. And I will say we have had conversations on the Evanston attempt at what they're calling reparations and some of the debate even about whether that even counts as reparations, as well as some of these other topics. You can find that on our website at 21stshow.org. As we're coming to the end of our time together, Caroline, I think last thought probably to you. We've spent this time talking about this history and its effects and, you know, what's lost when this history isn't talked about. Can you talk about, just make the case, why should people care about this history? Is this something that people ought to be paying more attention to?
Well, I think, you know, if I can use myself as an example, growing up in the United States, going through the school systems here, having one particular view about how slavery was way in the past, there, you know, it ended at a certain time. Abraham Lincoln had the Emancipation Proclamation. There's even a lot of complexity around that. That if we just know sort of these small nuggets of history, we may not be getting the full story. So, you know, I wanted to bring in the example of the Illinois Black Codes were not abolished until 1865. So that was a 46-year period in Illinois where there were all of these regulations around free Black movement, the remnants of slavery and servitude, petering out, so to speak. But did they really? Because when you have a legacy that's that long, and Brian has, you know, very, you know, clearly explained how things can get passed down. So I think that the one, the piece that I would land on is, how does it impact our thinking? How does it impact our mindset? And then how might that impact our attitudes and choices? And so the significance of learning about this history is we can have a much more holistic and welcoming view of our country, but also an understanding of the past, how it's all connected down through the centuries to the present. And can that impact us in our individual lives as well as in how we interact and engage in our communities?
Caroline Kissel is associate professor at DePaul University in the School of Continuing and Professional Studies. Brian Miller has also been with us, professor of sociology at Wheaton College in DuPage County, Illinois. Caroline and Brian, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for our program today. Before we go, I do want to mention later this week, on Wednesday, in fact, we're working on a program about gender-affirming care, specifically as it relates to trans youth. A number of states have banned this sort of care for trans youth, and while it's still available in Illinois, it's certainly a difficult landscape for kids and teens and their families to navigate. So we want to know what questions you have about how gender-affirming care works for trans youth. What effect do you think these care bans and other states are having? And especially if you know trans youth in your life, how are they doing? Get in touch. Talk at 21stshow.org is the address, or you can leave us a voicemail message anytime. 217-300-2121 is the number. 217-300-2121. You can find that and every other way to contact us on our website, 21stshow.org. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. I hope you have a good and meaningful Juneteenth holiday. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.